welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, October 20th, 2023. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we feature a segment from our most recent Off the Hill political panel. This month, the theme was Off the Hill, why we're in an affordable housing crisis and what to do about it. In this panel, our guests discussed how such a large-scale housing crisis can exist in such a wealthy country and discuss what needs to be done now to develop affordable, accessible housing for all. Our panel included Tanya Burkhart, Alex Hemingway, and Carl Nirenberg, co-hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. Here is a small clip from that panel. Take a listen.
Well, folks, according to the Angus Reid Institute Economic Stress Index, I didn't know there was such a thing, but there is, 3 in 10 Canadians are struggling to make ends meet in 2023, and that's up about 6 points from last year. And according to a housing affordability report by the Frontier Center for Public Policy, 2022 marked a concerning increase in severely unaffordable housing. So I think we all know we're experiencing a terrible housing crisis in this country of affordability, accessibility, and just it's affecting so many people. It is being felt by many, many Canadians. So I'm going to begin with you, Alex. If you'd like to turn on your camera, everybody can turn on their camera now. So, Alex, I've been following your work for quite a while at the CCPA and on Twitter. You do fantastic work researching, analyzing, bringing forward information on facts. So it seemed a good place to begin with you to kind of bring us up to date and to walk us through a little bit about what led to this crisis of housing in Canada. I know that's a huge question to ask you. But if you could just kind of, you know, give some pointers and highlights about why are we at this point of crisis of affordability?
Yeah, it's a big question, and I'll do my best. Of course, the housing crisis is very multifaceted. There are a lot of factors in play here, whether that's the state of rent control policies, tenant legal protections, the extent to which tenants are organized as a class. My colleague Ricardo Trangen has done some great work on that. What's happening with property and land taxation, what's happening with Airbnb, short-term rentals, empty homes, the central bank's interest rates. You know, there's a long list there. These all matter. But there are three key factors that I want to focus in on today that are fundamental to understanding and addressing the crisis we're in and really grasping the scale of it. So number one is the question of social housing. We've been through a period of decades now of chronic underinvestment in public and not-for-profit housing. Canada once did invest more substantially in social housing to the tune of about 20,000 units per year in the 70s and 80s. And part and parcel of the huge social spending cuts of the 90s, that housing investment from the public sector dropped off a cliff. And the result is today, a measly 3.5% share of our housing stock is social housing, which is about half of the OECD average. So we need to massively increase public investment in housing. All levels of government can contribute to that. You know, we've seen some reinvestment in the past several years, but at nowhere near the scale that's needed. And just the other on this point, you know, financially, a massive increase in public housing is actually very doable. You know, I've written about this, and we could talk in more detail about it if folks are interested in, you know, deeply affordable housing needs deep subsidies, and we need to raise tax revenue for that. But there are also a lot of possibilities in terms of building non-market housing for middle-income folks as well. Okay, so number two, Number one was social housing. Number two is the overall housing supply. There is quite simply a severe shortage of housing in this country, and particularly in our high demand, high rent cities. We've not been building enough for decades. We're still not. You can see it very clearly in the numbers. Housing construction starts per capita are about a third lower today than they were in the 1970s. And the real decline is worse than that, because housing demolitions are almost certainly higher today than they were in the past. New housing units are smaller. So in terms of the net new housing that's being created on an ongoing basis, it's disastrously low, and it has been for decades. And, you know, renters see this shortage very clearly with our own eyes. You know, anytime we're searching for an apartment, we're competing with dozens of other people, even for expensive units. We see it in suppressed household formation, you know, couples foregoing children, people living with parents, in living in inadequate housing, people already driven out of our high rent cities. There are plenty of folks who would like to move back to some of our big cities if it were more affordable. So, you know, the pent up need for housing is enormous. You can also see it in things like the vacancy rate data. It's very clear there, you know, that having ultra low vacancy rates, as we do in many of our cities, is extremely damaging to renters. It gives landlords enormous power. It drives up rents. Okay, so the third issue I wanted to touch on here connects both of the last two, and that's the question of exclusionary zoning policies. In most of our cities, local zoning policies mean that we effectively ban apartment buildings on 80% of our residential land. You can build the most expensive forms of low density market housing, like detached houses, anywhere you want, but you can't build apartments on most of the land. This has very damaging effects. It suppresses housing creation. It drives up the price of scarce parcels where multifamily housing is allowed. This is a problem for public and not-for-profit and private rental developers. I hear this from folks in the public and not-for-profit housing space all the time who work on creating that type of housing. Exclusionary zoning also causes displacement. When you can't build in the low density zones, the high wealth low density zones, all of the development is steered towards the existing apartment areas, which means demolition of older apartments and displacement that goes with that. It's a question of spatial equity. You know, most of our apartments are being built on loud, polluted arterial roads, which research shows is literally taking years off our lives. You know, I'm sitting next to a loud, polluted arterial road right now. I live in a co-op housing apartment. So we need to end the apartment ban. I'll just mention before I close up here, you know, here in Vancouver, one of our city councilors, Christine Boyle, put forward a great motion last year that would help address this. It would change the zoning policies to allow public and not-for-profit co-op housing everywhere across the city, up to 12 stories. That should be a no-brainer in a housing crisis. Unfortunately, the opposing council majority watered it down. They delayed that motion. The can's been kicked down the road to 2025. There's still a sliver of hope there, but you know, I'm not holding my breath with this council majority. So this is an example of the types of things that are possible. You know, another great example we can maybe talk about at some point is the very impressive development by the Squamish First Nation here in Vancouver, which is creating thousands of rental homes because it's not subject to Vancouver zoning constraints. So I better pause. I've talked for a while, but okay. Social housing, supply, exclusionary zoning, and many more. But those are the three I'll touch on.
Well, that's actually a great overview, Alex. And I thank you for that, because you did it very succinctly. And I would say that I think in more recent years, there's been more focus on the municipal side of exclusionary zoning. I think that's something relatively new in this housing crisis. And so I'm really glad you brought that up, and maybe we'll come back to it. But I actually want to turn to Tanya now, because Tanya, you're with Acorn Canada, which is a great organization across the country, advocates for low and moderate income families and is involved with various initiatives, not the least of which is affordable housing. You're the national spokesperson for ACORN, so we're very delighted to have you on today. And what I want to pose to you is, how would you characterize the various levels of government in providing this very basic human right for safe, affordable housing for Canadians? Has the government failed in this critical policy?
Thank you for having me here today. I would say that various levels of government, both federal, provincial, and municipal, the response has been inadequate. ACORN has advocated for tenants with skyrocketing rents. We deal with conditions in buildings, and so we're kind of a boots-on-the-ground organization. And we see every day kind of the consequences of some of the things that Alex has spoken about. We're stuck in precarious housing. And by precarious, I mean we could lose that housing based on rent eviction, demolition, condo conversion. The landlord wants to occupy the unit with their family. And so there's a lot of precariousness in housing. We also have tenants that live with mold, bed bugs, roaches. There's all kinds of really terrible conditions. And our rent keeps going up and up. And so there's this inequality between rent and the living conditions that we have. And basically we want to work and promote the acquisition of relatively affordable homes. And a lot of apartment units, buildings are owned by corporate landlords, REITs or private equity investors. And they buy up whatever affordable housing, these aging buildings that Alex spoke about. And their main motive is to take as much profit out of the building as possible, do no maintenance. And tenants are the unintended consequence of that process. And so ACORN in 2021 did a survey of 606 renters across Canada. And a lot of them don't even know who their landlord is. And so when they put in a maintenance request, they don't often know who the landlord is. And so tenants owned by corporate landlords, like I said, live in terrible conditions. And 19% of Ontario tenants with financialized landlords mentioned above guideline rent increases. So in the province of Ontario, a landlord can go before LTB and request more than the standard rent guideline. And so tenants often experience rents rising at a much faster rate based on the landlord just simply wanting more money. And we're losing affordable housing far faster than it's being created. Households of less than 5% in major centers have access to affordable units or available units. It's 1% in Vancouver and almost 0 in Ontario. So less than 1% in Ontario. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to move or find another apartment because vacancies are so few. National Housing Council has reported that we're losing housing faster and it's not being built with the same quantity. And 550,000 units of affordable housing were lost between 2011 and 2021. And the $40 billion National Housing Strategy has set a target to produce only 150,000 plus new affordable units over 10 years, starting in 2017. And so new affordable units aren't being built faster than they're being acquired and turned into an unaffordable product for tenants. And Canada's public and non-market and affordable housing stock is among the lowest at 3.5%. And so there's a real shortage of affordable housing. Affordable housing, we use the definition of 30% of net income. And so there's a lot of people who debate the definition of affordable housing. Some people say it's, 80% of average market rent or another figure, but we don't use that. And protecting existing affordable housing is kind of ACORN's focus. And new housing that is being created is typically luxury rental. We have a lot of units that are newly created, three-bedroom units that are well over $3,000 a month. And so we don't really think that that's affordable for low and moderate income people.
Okay. Well, I think you've described the situation very well, Tanya, especially for renters. And it does point to a failure of public policy, which I think we'll probably come back to in terms of, how things used to be in Canada, because we used to have very good housing policies. We used to have a national program. There used to be a good supply, as Alex mentioned earlier, but that is all either diminished or completely being eliminated by various levels of government. So I think we'll come back to that, but I'll turn it back over to Robin now.
Yeah, no, thanks, Libby. No, and thank you to you both for explaining how complex this issue is. Now, of course, we're called off the hill because we have a big focus on the federal government. So we want to kind of focus in a bit on that. So this will be a question for everybody. Earlier this year at a housing announcement in Hamilton, Prime Minister Trudeau said the issue of affordable housing mostly falls on provincial governments, claiming, quote, housing isn't a primary federal responsibility, unquote. Now, this comment received a lot of backlash. So we want to ask you all, what role should the federal government play in providing safe, secure, and affordable housing? And let's go Carl, Alex, and then back to Tanya.
So to start with, Justin Trudeau was in a way right in a technical sense in that the Constitution appears to award housing to the provinces in that it gives what they call municipal affairs to the provinces. But the Constitution also gives health to the provinces, for instance, and the federal government has gotten involved in health in a very, very big way. Now, there's lots of complaints about the federal government's participation, but the federal government is not about to say, we're going to do nothing about health because that's entirely provincial responsibility. It was because federal governments going back to the 60s got involved in health by putting money on the table that we got what we call the Medicare program that we have across Canada, ultimately, which started with one province, Saskatchewan, with the CCF and then NDP government in Saskatchewan. But the federal government has the right constitutionally based on they didn't write this down in 1867 because they couldn't foresee this. But the federal government, through many court decisions, has the right to spend its money anywhere it wants, including provincial jurisdiction, and it does all the time. And it does that freely all the time. And in housing, not only does the federal government have a right to be involved, but the federal government had been very involved going way back to World War II when it started something, I think it was called the Wartime Housing Corporation, and then afterwards they turned that into what they called the Central Mortgage and Housing Corporation, which then became the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation. At one time, something like half the houses in Canada were built with the support or participation of what we now call the CMHC. So the federal government has been involved in housing for a very, very long time. So it wasn't just bad politically and a bit shallow for our prime minister to make that unfortunate statement, but it was also not based on reality. It was based on a kind of very mechanical understanding of our Constitution that you do this and I do that, because we know in this country that the responsibilities are really intertwined, that the Constitution was written, the division of powers in the Constitution were written in the 19th century, toward the end of the 19th century, before the electric light bulb, never mind before the internet, at a time when notions of equality didn't exist, in times when you had virtual slavery, in times when there's no such thing as a minimum wage, in times when it was considered normal for people to die of poverty, and that was just what happened. So that's a long time ago. We know that it's not supposed to be some kind of steel trap or box, our Constitution, that means that you can't adapt, and we have, and that's why we have our national standards on health, and that's why we have first the federal participation in health, then the Canada Health Act, and that's why we have the CMHC. And so there's a very, very big role for the federal government. The federal government has, in economists' terms, the greatest fiscal capacity of any order of government. It has the greatest capacity to get money, to tax money. It does. You know, the federal government is the only government in Canada that can impose customs duties on imports, for instance. It has all kinds of capacity to tax resource development in the offshore or in the territories. It has enormous capacity to get revenue and to borrow money, and so it has to use that its wealth and its economic power to the good, regardless of where the technical constitutional responsibility is. And it has, when it's been enlightened, it has done so.
Okay. No. Thank you, Carl. Let's bring in Alex. And Alex, talking about the role of the federal government in housing, and if you can go back and speak, you mentioned three big areas: social housing, overall housing supply, and exclusionary zoning. Where should the feds be involved in those three things?
Look, they can play a role in all three. You know, there's a lot of finger pointing and pass the buck between levels of government on the housing crisis. Every level has powerful levers. Federally, first and foremost, as Carl was getting at, the federal government has deep pockets. It should pony up with major new investment in dedicated affordable housing, non-market housing, public housing. It can do that either through provincial funding transfers to allow agencies like BC Housing here in BC to do more public housing, but it can also get involved in building directly itself. It can also, you know, one thing that it's currently doing but not enough of is providing low-cost loans to nonprofit housing providers and rental housing providers. Those programs should be expanded alongside that direct investment. It's also the case that the feds can play a role in zoning. And we're hearing more about that recently at a rhetorical level, that the action doesn't necessarily match the rhetoric so far. But, you know, you have heard the federal level Liberal government talk about exclusionary zoning. You know, Polyev talks about gatekeepers. And I think it's important we keep in mind that, you know, the idea that they're talking about of conditioning federal funds on local zoning reforms, that's an idea with progressive origins. That came from AOC in the States, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders. It's not a bad idea, but it has to be done in a serious way. And so that's one of the complementary pieces that a federal government can do as well.
Great. Well, thanks, yeah. Alex. Tanya, did you want to add something?
I think there's a lot that the federal government can do. I think financially they have the largest amount of funding to make housing initiatives possible. And ACORN has had a Stop Financialized Landlord campaign for quite some time. And we're asking the federal government to give the right of first refusal to apartment building purchases for land trust co-ops and tenants and nonprofits. And this will allow them to have the financial backing to purchase buildings rather than having them go to corporate landlords. They could mandate full federal rent control. So that means a ban on AGIs, vacancy control. There's a lot of initiatives that can go into rent control. So imagine that across Canada federally. We want to have the full disclosure of who landlords are and who owns properties, because sometimes that's not always clear. We have a large number of companies. We want the federal government to tie CMHC funding to target tenants in core housing need. And that means is that that the housing has to be adequate. It has to meet their needs. It has to be affordable. And so we believe CMHC funding should be tied to that. We need the federal government to plug the tax loophole in the Income Tax Act so that REITs and large corporate landlords pay their fair share of taxes. And any benefits that they receive through CMHC should require institutional investors to commit 20% in their residential buildings that they receive funding for to social housing. So it's a great way they get the funding and social housing can automatically be built.
That was a small clip from our most recent panel, Off the Hill, Why We're in an Affordable Housing Crisis and What to Do About It. To watch the full video of our panel, please visit Rabble TV or Rabble's YouTube channel. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Let's jump right in. This week in Canadian politics, all parties took part in a debate in the House of Commons on Monday, October 16th, to discuss the ongoing war between Israel and Hamas. On October 7th, the terrorist group Hamas attacked Israeli settlements and perpetrated the largest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust. Israel has responded by bombing Hamas's stronghold in the Gaza Strip, killing many Palestinian civilians living there and cutting them off from food, fuel, and water. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh told the House, quote, "We condemn Hamas and the brutal murders of whole families and the taking of hostages. We cannot allow the world to use this terrorism to justify the human catastrophe unfolding before our eyes in Gaza," end quote. Also this week, on our sister podcast, Needs No Introduction, a new episode of the Courage My Friends series was released. This week, host Resh Badu puts the lens on climate as she spotlights the 24th annual Planet in Focus International Environmental Film Festival. She talks to festival executive director Catherine Bruce, filmmaker Deirdre Leowinata on her documentary Keepers of the Land, and also Liz Marshall and Alfonso Salinas on the premiere of their feature-length documentary See You Yao, Awaken. The 24th annual Planet in Focus International Film Festival is running until October 22nd. If you're in Toronto, be sure to check out these incredible films. Finally, in labor news this week, new academic research shows that the use of surveillance technology to monitor farm workers could lead to negative health outcomes. Olivia Doggett, a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto, found that some farms are using surveillance technology to enforce production quotas. This could lead to some farm workers going to work when they are injured or sick, or may lead to injuries on the job in an attempt to meet quotas. Surveillance technology has also been used to punish underperforming workers. According to the United Food and Commercial Workers, one greenhouse punished the five worst performing farm workers with no work or pay for 2 to 3 days. To read the full versions of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like us. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.